Good morning. Welcome to Africa Gender Indaba, your weekly platform where we focus on gender justice, human rights, and development in the continent of Africa. My name is Kopotso Budibe. Thank you for joining us through all our channels via PES-10 satellite in sub-Saharan Africa, DSTV audio bouquet channel 802, and online on www.channelafrica.co.za all over the world. Follow us on Twitter to communicate with us. Our handle is @AfricaGender. Yes, that's the handle of the show. In this week's edition of Africa Gender Indaba, we'll hear about research focusing on how male migrant men who live in OECD countries and who are married to or related to women who have undergone female genital mutilation can help them access healthcare services. But first, in Eswatini, Gwaka Invoza, an organization that works with men and boys to challenge negative masculinities, is working on a campaign to challenge fathers in the Swati Kingdom to reflect and change their ways to adopt a more active role in the home, including childcare responsibilities in a deeply patriarchal and conservative society. To hear more about the campaign, I earlier connected with Tom Churchyard, Executive Director of Gwaka Invoza. Tom, thank you so much for your time here on Africa Gender Indaba. Your organization, Gwaka Invoza, is planning a campaign called Babi Lekofo, which translates to Good Dad. Let's start by defining what a good dad is and why there is a need for such a campaign with a specific focus on the context of Eswatini.
Thanks, Kapoto. Yes, as you said, we've got a campaign that was launched in March of this year called Babi Lekofo. And I think you really hit the biggest question first in saying that it's very difficult to describe what a good dad really is. However, what we want to do through this campaign is really ask those difficult and introspective questions to men to say, what role do you play in the home? What role do you play in child raising? And are you being as good as you can be? Are you aiming to be the best that you can be in those two spheres? A lot of the time in Eswatini, just like in South Africa, we find that men feel their role to be one of breadwinning and feel that they provide for their families through performing that task, and therefore don't need to maybe interact in some of the other ways with their children or with the domestic duties as much as women do. But what we know and what evidence from across the whole world has shown us is that when men do involve themselves in those kind of responsibilities, then everybody benefits, men, women, children. And so that's the reason why we really wanted to launch this campaign here in Eswatini.
This is a very big concern in many parts of Africa and indeed worldwide, I must say, that the role of fathers seems to be lacking. The role of fathers seems to not be visible. You are looking at launching the campaign in a number of communities around Eswatini. You're actually running it in a number of communities. One of these communities is the township of Mahwalala, just outside the capital, Mbabane. Talk to us about your observations in this particular community and why you are targeting it with this intervention.
We chose Mahwalala because, just like in South Africa, there are suburban areas, townships, if you will, popping up very quickly here in Eswatini around the urban centres. And these suburban townships are often very much underserved. They are underserved not only by basic needs such as utilities and security, but they're also underserved by social services as well. You know, we find that clinics in these areas are usually very overrun. Policing and other securities are usually stretched. And the population density in these areas keeps growing. And so what happens with a very young population, these areas become very attractive to people trying to make their first early stages in their life and their career. And so these areas are growing, but the scant securities and social services in these areas are not being able to match them. So as these young people become families, then we find that, you know, again, they're trying to balance work and new families. And this often leads to family insecurity, to violence, to male absenteeism at times, and to this belief that it's a man's job to earn money and women mostly are responsible for the home and the child rearing duties in a house. So we find that in these areas, just like in rural areas, there's a lot of gender inequalities, a lot of strict gender norms.
You are tuned into Africa Gender Indaba right here on Channel Africa, your station that broadcasts from the African perspective via PES 10 satellite in sub-Saharan Africa, DSTV audio bouquet, channel 802, and online on www.channelafrica.co.za. I am Khoboso Budibe. I am with Tom Churchyard, Executive Director of Gwaka Indvoza, an organization working to promote gender equality among men and boys in the Southern African country of Eswatini. We're discussing Babi Lotlofo, a campaign the organization is currently running to challenge men's and boys' attitudes to home caring and child-raising responsibilities. What are your thoughts on this topic? Tweet at Africa Gender to let us know. We'll read out your tweets later on in the program. But in the meantime, let's hear more from Tom Churchyard. Tom, in total, how many communities are you actually looking at targeting?
So this campaign is a national campaign. A lot of it is based online, on online awareness raising. However, we are looking at two townships in and around Babane, the capital city of Eswatini, so that we can also have this interaction with real men and particularly new and expectant fathers as they go through the journey of fatherhood. We know that antenatal clinics, antenatal services are very scant, and that there's not really any guidance to men or women on various elements of becoming a new parent, the stresses and strains, the responsibilities, the functions such as breastfeeding, sleepless nights, nappy changing, etc. And that when these services do exist, they pretty much entirely, solely focus on women. And so men are either by their own absenteeism or by the fact that these services are targeted at women, they are often not engaged or taught or mentored or workshopped on how to be fathers, especially in these high density populated areas. And so, you know, when it comes their turn to actually become fathers, they don't really know how.
And this is what you are seeking to address. You're seeking to change this way of doing things, to change the narrative. Tom, you have actually spoken a bit about the format or the model that the campaign will follow. I'd like for you to speak in detail about the elements that it will include and who you're targeting.
So, as I said earlier, the in-person elements of the campaign are targeting new and expectant fathers. In Eswatini, that's usually between 25 and 35 years of age. And then the more wider national campaign is mostly based online on our social media feeds, but also in print and TV, radio, media channels. And this is really widening the scope of awareness raising around this issue and around some of the silences that we as a nation and Southern Africa as a region have had around fatherhood for a long time now. And so this national campaign is more online and more in traditional media as well to push the idea that men can involve themselves in the home and that they should be speaking out to challenge some of the social and gender norms that create and excuse absenteeism and violence in our homes. And so that campaign next month is going to focus on Father's Day, and after that going to continue to encourage men to do things like post pictures of themselves in fatherhood roles on social media. So we've had, you know, challenges released just this week where men are being challenged to speak out about some of these functions that they might do at home, but that they often don't talk about. And they certainly don't necessarily want to be celebrated for in those roles, to encourage other men to do the same thing and to take a more active role. So we'll be doing elements like a national photography competition in order to have an exhibition later on this year of men playing that fatherhood role, and also a letter writing competition. And so we're encouraging young people to write letters as a letter to my father, to really explore some of these issues of both present and positive fatherhood.
What I'm reading from what you're saying, Tom, is that one of the aims of the campaign is to build and showcase male role models in parenting, something that we lack in many communities. And this is not because there are no role models. The problem is they are not visible. Why is this the case, and why is it necessary to have visible role models?
I think men are performing a lot of these roles sometimes. There is a huge contingent of people who do not perform these roles, who stick to some very rigid gender norms, much to their detriment and to their family's detriment. But I think there's also an equally exciting and large group of men who are performing these roles, but they fall short of talking about them, whether that's through fear of being ostracized or judged by other men, or sometimes by other women, or for an understanding that they feel that in some way they're not supposed to perform these roles. But a lot of the time, behind closed doors, we find that men are performing some of the duties that constitute an active, present father figure. But they don't like to talk about it. And so what we want to do is also create an environment whereby men feel comfortable, more comfortable, less judged in talking about these roles, in showcasing some of the things that they do, without that undue praise that we sometimes lavish upon men who are just doing what should be natural. You know, we often overpraise gender equal men for doing something as if it were superhuman. We're saying that this should be normal, should be natural, and should be something that we speak about normally and naturally, as well as celebrating and showcasing role models for other men to do the same.
It's a difficult task, isn't it? On the one hand, you want to say that men should not be over-celebrated for doing what they should be doing in the first place, carrying a child on their back, like one pastor in Eswatini who actually had images of him on social media carrying his child on his back when his partner was not around. And the deputy prime minister of Eswatini had pictures as well of himself washing dishes. And there was divided opinion in the country based on those images. Some actually saying that this is not what a man should be doing, this is not manly. And then others saying that actually this is what a man should be doing. This is just human nature.
Certainly. And I think the line is always something that we should be conscious of as gender rights activists. You know, the superhero complex is real. I'm a pro-feminist man who's been doing this work for a decade, and I still have to check my own accountability at times as to when and how we celebrate pro-feminist men doing gender equal roles in society and advocating for that. I think when it comes to fatherhood's a life journey and a lifelong responsibility. And I think we should be celebrating those that humbly, quietly engage in that lifelong journey and lifelong responsibility over the sort of smaller celebrations that might happen when somebody washes the dishes or does a once-off kind of task. So it's a tough balancing act, Kapoto, but there is a space there, I feel, for people who have day in, day out, men and women, taken on these child raising and family responsibilities.
This is Africa Gender Indaba with me, Kgopotso Bodibe, right here on Channel Africa, your station that broadcasts from the African perspective. Our guest is Tom Churchyard, Executive Director of Gwakha Indvodza. We're discussing a campaign that the organization has launched to promote a positive culture towards home care work and raising children among men and boys in Eswatini. Earlier, I requested that you send us your thoughts on the topic via our Twitter handle, @AfricaGender. You have listened, and here's what you have to say on the topic. Someone who goes by the Twitter handle, @ILoveQuotes, tweets and says, "Not every successful man is a good father, but every good father is a successful man." @Ubuntu says, "This is basic common sense wisdom in modern Africa. Good dads are just as important as good mothers." @Ndogozo Gababa tweets and says, "A good father teaches his son how to love a woman by how he loves his mother. He grooms him to be a real gentleman." And here's a tweet from at Student of Life, it says the desire to be a good father is the necessary ingredient to become one. I know. I've done it 4 times. Good dads are vital to society. Let's avoid messing up our children's lives. Let's build their confidence, provide stability, give them much love. That's what I have learned as a father. Oh, yes, that's very appropriate and sound advice. Thank you all for your contributions to this topic, promoting good fatherhood. Now, let's go back to our conversation with Tom Churchyard, whose organization, Gwaka Indvodza, is on a mission to challenge the patriarchy and conservatism that feeds perceptions of a masculinity that says that men and boys cannot be caregivers. Tom, talk to us about the overall objectives of the campaign. What are the objectives? I'd imagine that some of your objectives are to advocate for and to influence policy formulation and reform.
So when we were planning the campaign, Kapoto, that certainly was on our minds. We have a very small government-supported parental leave here in Eswatini. In fact, it's some of the lowest parental leave quota in the world. And South Africa, having amended its paternity leave obligations to 10 days, we hoped that this campaign would be able to put pressure on policymakers and lawmakers to be able to do the same here in Eswatini. I think it's important to lay the groundwork for policy change to come in 2021 and 2022, whereby we might be able to advocate with lawmakers and legislators that paternity leave is a human right, is a legal necessity, and is good for both the social and economic development of a country.
How can people in Eswatini participate in the program? It's running online already on several social media platforms.
Yes, it's running online on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and there are some videos on YouTube that we are posting every couple of weeks as well. As I say, later on in the year, there is a photography exhibition, which will be free of charge, and it will be hopefully exhibited in 4 major cities in Eswatini. We have a current photography competition going on right now. So if you are a keen amateur photographer, you can get your camera out and take a picture of either you and your father or you as a father and submit that to the competition. There are some great cash prizes up for grabs.
Fantastic. How do people actually get hold of you on Facebook and on Twitter? What are the hashtags? What are the handles?
We are Gwaka Indvodza on Facebook, on Twitter, and also under Gwaka Indvodza organizational page on Instagram. And we are using the hashtags Babelekopo, hashtag The Good Dad Campaign, and hashtag Positive Fatherhood.
Thank you to Tom Churchyard, Executive Director of Gwaka Indvodza, an organization based in Eswatini that works to promote gender justice among men and boys. He was speaking with us about a new campaign called Babelekopo, or the Good Dad Campaign, that the organization is currently running in that country. Now, let's focus on another man who is doing important work to further gender justice in Africa. Mark Dwira, who hails from Ghana, is a student at the University of Nottingham in the UK. He is studying for a PhD in nursing, and he's conducting research focusing on how migrant men living in OECD countries can help their wives or female relatives who have undergone female genital mutilation, FGM, access healthcare services for complications arising out of the procedure. Mark joins us here on Africa Gender Indaba to talk to us about his research.
Mark, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for joining us here on Africa Gender Indaba. Tell us about the study that you have conducted here. First of all, the format of the study and the rationale driving the study.
Okay, so this systematic review I'm currently conducting is part of my PhD research. And so the rationale behind it is basically to draw away a little bit from the current narrative of the globe, focusing mainly on the prevention, leaving behind those women and girls who have been affected by the practice. And so the rationale behind the whole systematic review was to actually explore how better policymakers and stakeholders can shift their attention to addressing the health consequences associated with FGM in those people who have already been affected by the practice, how better we can improve their health, their well-being, for them to also live in good health. And so basically that is the rationale behind the systematic review that I conducted.
Can you define health for us in the study? What is it exactly that you're looking at?
So I'm actually looking at the WHO's definition, that is the three parameters, the physical, mental, social, and the psychological aspect of women who have been affected by FGM. And so in simple terms, my research seeks to focus on how the effect of female genital mutilation really impacts women's psychological health, the social well-being, as well as the physical health. I'm looking at how those services provided for them that seeks to address these specific issues done and done well, so that women who have been affected by the practice will also live in healthy conditions and can carry on with their day-to-day activities.
And your focus is actually on men, how men are actually helping to ensure that the women and the girls do indeed acquire those health services. Is that correct?
Yes.
Talk to us about that. How are you going about actually doing this research? Are you speaking with the men, or are you reviewing studies that are available that have been conducted already?
At the moment, I'm actually reviewing literature studies that have been conducted on men, looking at the various aspects of the FGM practice. I'm currently conducting a systematic review that seeks to inform policymakers as to the significance of incorporating men into the care services, as to how men's role can be crucial in helping women to actually take up the services provided. The systematic review is actually going to inform the central focus of the PhD. And so it is then after I am going to actually interview people. I'm going to interview men. I am only going to focus on men and not women. Men who are married to women with FGM, and also men who have any relation with people with FGM.
I understand that your research is focusing on OECD countries. There are 35, 36 OECD countries in the world. Now, the research that you are conducting, or that you have conducted already, where does it concentrate?
The research concentrates on about 14 FGM prevalent developed countries. And it actually includes New Zealand, it includes the UK, it includes Germany, Sweden, the United States, Spain, Australia, and Italy. It's actually focusing on about 14 countries. That is countries where they've got migrants living with FGM there. And so among the 36 countries that are actually under the OECD countries, I'm only focusing on countries that have reported on the presence of women with FGM.
These migrant communities that you're focusing on, do they by any chance still practice FGM in the countries that they have actually migrated to?
At the moment, there hasn't been any research that indicating that, except the UK, just recently in 2019, a woman was prosecuted for performing FGM on her child.
Mark, talk to us now about your focus on men's experiences and views towards female genital mutilation and its prevention and care in OECD countries. First of all, why did you look at that as a focus area? And what is it that you actually are finding out as a result of the review that you have been conducting?
First of all, let me address the reason why I chose that particular topic. Mm-hmm. A systematic review conducted on the role of men in the prevention of FGM actually indicated that actually includes studies in Africa and some studies in the developed countries. That includes Italy, the UK, Sweden, Norway, and some other countries. It indicated that men are actually keen in preventing female genital mutilation because of the health consequences, because of the physical and the psychological, the psychosocial implications that it has on them as well as women. Research has shown that men, particularly those who are married to women with FGM, actually undergo through some psychosexual implications, and some have difficulty in actually enjoying sex, and others even have infections as a result of their intimacy with their wives, particularly women who have actually undergone the infibulation, which is the type 3. That has to do with removing all the labia majora, and the clitoris and the labia minora, and searching it to have a very small hole. men, particularly those who are married to those women, have actually revealed that these are some of the consequences. The consequences they go through actually goes beyond just the physical difficulty they go through as a result of having intimacy with their wife, but the psychosexual and the psychological implications, because they cannot really enjoy, they can't enjoy sex. And so the main reason why I focused on men is the fact that men, particularly those who are married to women with FGM, also have some form of challenges that need to be addressed. And so basically, the research is to inform policymakers and practitioners that men need to also be provided with some form of care services. And then the other question has to do with the care process in OECD countries. Apart from the primary health care services that have been provided for everybody, there are specialized services provided for women with any of the types of genital mutilation. And so that is one thing that my research is to explore. So assessing all the care services and then assessing how those care services are carried out and assessing how women with FGM are also assessing the services. And then the gap that my research is to fill is that, can men also be part of these services, looking at the evidence indicating that men also endure some form of health challenges?
You're still tuned in to Africa Gender Indaba on Channel Africa, your station that broadcasts from the African perspective via PES 10 satellite in sub-Saharan Africa and on DSTV audio bouquet channel 802 and online on www.channelafrica.co.za. Thank you for joining us and welcome. My name is Kgopotso Bodibe and I am with Mark Dwira, a Nottingham University PhD in nursing student. For his studies, he is conducting research examining how migrant men in OECD countries can help women around them who have undergone FGM from their countries of origin access healthcare services. Before we carry on with our conversation, let's find out what some of you are saying on Twitter to contribute to this conversation. At Tony Muyebia says, men should care about FGM and stand alongside women and girls to help them prevent the practice and to address its consequences. Babes Cisse tweets and says, FGM is not fair. Women and girls don't have to be cut to be validated by anyone. Do you know how many people had a dissolved marriage due to FGM? People need to be educated about FGM. It does not affect women only, but men as well. Here's a tweet from at Hibo Wadere. It says, there must be no more hiding from men. If you have a wife who was mutilated, you know how it affects you. Be true and fight. And the last tweet that we have time for is from Dr. Tamari. She says, in order for FGM to end, men must be honest and own up to how it affects them too. Strategies to end FGM must involve them. Thank you for your views on this topic. Now let's resume our chat with Mark Dwira to hear more about his research. In this segment, Mark tells us about his interim findings in his ongoing study.
The findings that I've now come out with is the fact that men are eager to prevent, are eager to stop the practice in developed countries. But then majority of these papers that I've actually researched are pointing to the fact that the legal implications or the legal approach that has been adopted in many developed countries, the studies reveal that men see them to be too harsh, particularly when it comes to the care for women with FGM. Because within the developed countries, what happened is that women who are even seeking care for the challenges they go through have to actually go through the legal procedures. And so when a woman is first identified, in the UK, for example, there is what we call the tracking system. The tracking system in the UK seeks to put an indicator on a woman who has been mutilated, indicating that woman, the likelihood of a woman repeating the practice, if he's got a child who is a female, is high. And so that assumption has actually created that particular tracking system on women with FGM. And research has actually disproved that particular whole concept that women who have actually undergone FGM are not willing to repeat it on their case because of the trauma they are already facing. And so men in this view are saying that they prefer the legal consequences associated with the practice to remain, but then it should be much more flexible when it comes to the care services so that women who have got a practice can patronize the services provided for them. And because of that, recent research actually indicated that women feel frightened and women are afraid for accessing the care services. not because of the fact that the services are not provided for them, but then because of the emotional and the stigma they are going to go through for the fact that they've been mutilated. And so if they are seeking for care, and the only thing they are getting out from the care is to find ways and means to track them and even prosecute them, then they are not taking up the care services at all. And so these are the two main findings that the research is pointing to, that the legal approaches that have been adopted to prevent the practice is harsh, and therefore there should be some form of flexibility, especially in the area of care for women with female genital mutilation.
You say that the research says that men are concerned that the laws that have been adopted in relation to FGM are not flexible, they are harsh. Are these the laws that are implemented in OECD countries?
Yes, about 12 of the OECD countries have in place FGM laws, banning all FGM. These 12 countries have criminalized female genital mutilation. And so if the practice is performed in and outside of these, of any of these 12 countries, it is an offense. And that offense, particularly in the UK, is tantamount to 14 years imprisonment and a fine, depending on the nature of the practice. One thing the law in the UK does is that if a mom or dad takes
their child to their country of origin, say
to a country of origin in Somalia or Ghana, and FGM is performed there, what happens is that when the child comes and he tells the state that this is what my mom and dad went to do to me at that particular country, because the law in the UK has extrajudicial mandates of prosecuting people who take British citizens outside the country to perform FGM, that mom or dad need to face the full force of the law.
So now, what is the research that you have been conducting showing? Is it that the men are saying that performing FGM is a rite of passage that should be allowed and should not be criminalized? They should not be prosecuted for taking their children for FGM back to their countries of origin, for example, back to Ethiopia, back to Kenya. Is that what the men are saying in the study, in the literature that you are reviewing?
At this point, there are actually contrasting views, but the majority of the studies that I've actually reviewed so far is pointing to the fact that most male migrants are actually advocating for the stoppage of the practice because of the health implications that are associated with it, because of their knowledge in human rights of trying to infringe on the integrity, the physical integrity of women and girls. And then because of the legalities, most of them, as a result of the legal implications associated with the practice, have actually put a halt to that, and they wouldn't want to be prosecuted. But then on the other side of it, there are still men who still believe that for the reason of manageability and for the reason of men's sexual pleasure and for the reason of helping to maintain the polygamous traditions that men in Africa do have, and once they've traveled here, most men cease to focus on this main purpose to say that FGM should continue, because once the woman is not cut, they have the belief that women remain promiscuous, infidelity sets in. But then these are few studies that have been conducted. This study I'm talking about actually comprised of people from Djibouti, people from Gambia, people from Sierra Leone, people from Sudan, people from Nigeria, and people from Ghana as well. These men were in favor of the practice, not because of the fact that they have not seen the legal implications. And these men were those who complained that the legal implications are harsh. They see it as a form of imposition, in a sense that they feel they were not consulted enough before those laws were drafted. And so what they are advocating for, even in developed countries, is the fact that there should be an inclusive dialogue between the government, affected individuals, and affected communities, so that they will know that the government are really addressing what they need, not what the government needs to impose it on them.
Clearly, these are voices of men who still want to exert power over women, men who still want to control women's bodies, men who want to control women's sexual and reproductive health, men who are still driven by patriarchy.
Yeah.
Mark, just to wrap up, what is the end goal of this study that you are conducting? What would you want to see as the end goal?
So, first of all, I would want to help empower men, particularly those who still have these perceptions, those who still hold on to patriarchy as a medium of controlling women's sexuality and their reproductive health, of controlling the body of women, of trying to still hold on to the traditions that seek to suppress women. And so what my research used to do is that, because my research is in care, I'm actually proposing that there should be some form of healthcare services provided for men, or in the development of any referral pathway in the developed countries, men need to be included in the development of referral pathway, so that men who are actually going through some form of psychological or psychosexual consequences as a result of their intimacy with women with FGM can also access care services in the developed countries, and to inform policymakers to consider the inclusion of men in the planning of care services provided for women with FGM.
Just a cynical question, Mark, that any other person can actually ask. The harm that is conducted when FGM is performed is on the woman, it's not on the man. FGM is ostensibly performed on girls, on women, for the enjoyment, for the pleasure of men. So why should there be a focus on men?
The simple answer to it is, if actually we want to ensure that the well-being of families are well maintained, because these migrant communities are families living together, men's voice hasn't been heard on the part of the care aspect, in the sense that there hasn't been any work done within this particular area. There hasn't been any form of real studies exploring or bringing out all these specific issues that men also confront or men also face. The basic foundation for the practice of female genital mutilation, although it has, men are the basic foundation for the practice of female genital mutilation. And so therefore, if you are to say that FGM is a woman's thing, I can argue from the perspective that the underlying reason is for men. And so therefore, if men are to be involved, one in the campaign, one in the care, like it has been done in the area of sexual and reproductive health, where men have helped women immensely to actually take up these care services provided in these sectors, the uptake of family planning services, according to research, has shown to actually increase because of the involvement of men helping their partners or their siblings to take up these family planning services, like contraceptives, like the use of condom, and all these things. And so if it has been done in this particular related field, then my research is arguing from the point that why not exploring from this particular side in the case of female genital mutilation, and see whether, one, the experiences men go through can actually be used as a medium to help in the prevention process of female genital mutilation, and also see whether those who particularly are married to women with FGM, not only for the sexual pleasure, because research has shown that they are also going through some form of difficulty, those services provided can include them to be able to also ensure that they live a healthy life and can promote the abandonment of FGM within their circles. Because once they are involved in the care services, once they are involved in the preventive services, what is going to happen is that they are going to lead. They are going to open up conversations, and their practice will be a thing of the past. That is what I believe, and that is why I'm advocating for the inclusion of men, not only in the prevention side, but the care aspect of it too as well.
Mark, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much. God bless Africa.
That was Mark Dwira, a Ghanaian PhD in nursing student at the University of Nottingham in the United Kingdom. He was speaking with us about research that he is conducting on the experiences and views of men on female genital mutilation and its prevention and care in OECD countries. And with that conversation, we come to the end of this week's edition of Africa Gender Indaba. Thank you for joining me, Khopotso Budibe, here on Channel Africa, your station that broadcasts from the African perspective. Join me again next week, Tuesday, at the same time on the same station for another Africa Gender Indaba. In the meantime, to get a podcast of this edition, visit us online at www.channelafrica.co.za. For now, goodbye and take care.